everyone to the second day of the Asia House Library Foundation Literature Festival. We've got a really, really excellent night ahead, two different parts, and this is the first part. I want to first say a warm thank you to ALCA and the Library Foundation for their continued support. This is the second year of a really great partnership. And also to thank the Arts Council, as well as Dishoom, who have provided the lovely snacks and the alcohol and drinks for tonight. And now, I want to introduce the illustrious panel. So, we have Vaya Naru, who is a professional storyteller. She established the first intercultural storytelling company with the British Council, and she now looks at storytelling in fiction as well. Joining her on stage is Seema Anand, who is an expert on the art of seduction, as I think you'll all find out later on. She performs at the British Museum, the V&A, and Asia House. And then we have in the chairing tonight is Bhavit Mehta, who is the founder of the South Asian Literature Festival and is currently at the British Council. I want you to all wish, you know, welcome me, welcome them.
Great, okay. Can you all hear me? It's a small room, so hopefully everyone can hear me. Thank you for the lovely introduction, Jemima. Thank you for inviting the three of us to come and share our thoughts and ideas on this subject of fairy tales and happy ever after. It's been a very strange 24 hours where we've had excitement of going to a polling station and putting in our votes. We've had to make some decisions, some hard ones, some harsh ones. We've met people that we know and our neighbours and relatives when we go to the polling station. We've had frustration of waiting in a queue for very long. Then a whole day of deliberation of what will happen and what if this happens and that happens, etc., etc. And a whole night of watching David Dimbleby, or Paxman, as I was watching last night on Channel 4, sharing their thoughts on what may happen. Frustrated MPs who lose their seats, excited MPs who win new seats. And then this morning you see a very smug Prime Minister who has re-won his seat and three resignations and 5 more years of David Cameron. Is there a happy ending to this story?
I'm actually not the right person to ask about this particular happy ending because I had so much trouble trying to figure out which fairy tale I would use to describe this lot. By which fairy tale would you have used to describe this lot?
That was a trick question. That was just to make you laugh, because I think if an audience laughs at the start of a talk, then we're on the right part. So we're going to not talk about David Cameron, thank God. We're going to talk about this wonderful treasure of Indian tales. Now, there's a whole spectrum of them. You have folklore, folk tales, mythology, history, and often amongst these things, the lines are pretty blurred. So when we talk about something like the Ramayana, is it a historical tale? Is it a mythological tale? Is it a fairy tale? Is it an epic? Is it a scripture? Is it a folk story? And there's so many different versions. So which version is the historical version? Which version is the mythological version? And I think this can be applied to so many of our tales, whether they're the Puranic stories, whether they're the epic tales, whether they're the Panchatantra tales, or the Jataka tales, or the wonderful folk tales you find in Punjab, in Gujarat, in Tamil Nadu, and all different parts of India, the Sufi tales that are often recited in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in those areas. And really, where can we define what is a fairy tale and what isn't? Maybe Bayuji, you can begin with that. Sort of. Try to define this. What are we talking about today?
I don't think we need to get into sort of academic references. And one thing I think, although we're speaking English in Asia House, I'm going to turn it into how a South Asian way of thinking about these tales is. And I think it's so important, Bhavit, that you mentioned, how do we look at these tales? You know, are they historical, are they legends, are they mythologies? I think those categorizations are very Eurocentric, and we have learned to read things that way. Mm. But if you look at it from within the dye of the fabric of an Indian imagination, or a South Asian, or an Indic imagination, it is in the telling of the tale that you get the focus. So when we have 1,500 Ramayanas, the focus of Kampan's Ramayana from Tamil is very different. Tulsidas's emphasis is very different. It's, you know, it's a bhakti. You'll have the Kirtivasa Bengali Ramayana. That focus is very different. So in a way, there is a pattern by which the Indic tale telling, classic telling, is categorized. But we live in such a rich moment of bridging those worlds, you know, traversing across these civilizations, that we tend to look at it, how do we label this? Because Ramayana has its historical moment. It does, before psychology was invented, it has its emotive sensibilities and nuances. It is about statecraft. It is talking about relationships between brothers and so on. So that's really, I know we've got lots to discuss.
Yeah. No,
so I just thought that was one way. I just want to turn the way we look at tales. So a whole Dravidian way of looking at Sita and Rama is also so extremely different, and then within its historical time. So my suggestion is, let's look at those Asian ways of categorizing. For example, with the Turkish lie, in English we say it's a lie, but in a Turkish story, it's a constant finding a balance between two opposites. I got up this morning and my head was in my pocket. My ear fell off and my tongue was licking the sea. You know, it's those kind of opposites. So I think we need to look at it from a different dimension.
Different dimension. It's interesting. And Simaji, the tales that you often tell, I've had the privilege of hearing you for a few years, and a variety of your tales tend to be on the darker side.
You do, yes.
Which I absolutely love. It's my favorite type of tale, the dark tale. And so where, within those tales, where do you feel they fit in the European way of definition, but then also looking at from what Bayoji said, from the Indian perspective, or the South Asian perspective?
Okay, so I'm actually going to tell you about last year I lectured on the idea of fairy tales and changing the ending of a fairy tale to fit in with life as it is with us today. And so, in one particular European capital, we were at this university, it was postgraduates and over, and we were in a workshop situation. And it was interesting, because the first thing that came up is that when we talk about Eastern tales, we talk about myth. We don't refer to them as fairy tales, but when we talk Western stories, we talk fairy tales. And so the linguistics become completely different. For some reason, we refer to this as fairy tales and that as mythology. And somehow, I don't know, maybe that informs the content just a little bit of our stories, because with mythologies, you'll notice that there is still a lot of layering. You know, there are perspectives. There are other people thinking about things. There is there's a lot of psychology and subtlety that goes into it. As it travels westwards and becomes the fairy tale, even before the sanitization of the fairy tale, you know, when it's still kind of grim and dark, there, even in the grim, dark bit, there isn't enough layering. It's more black and white. More black, but still black and white. As it becomes sanitized and becomes the modern-day fairy tale, it becomes so single-dimensional that it's actually only white. So there's the element of choice has been removed almost completely. So there isn't this thing of, we should do this because it's such a good thing to do. Well, I don't think it's a good thing. Well, I did this because... It's very much about right and wrong, and as it becomes sanitized, it becomes very much about right, whether anybody else thinks it's right or not. So we had this workshop that we were running, and I said to them, let's change the ending of the tale. And that's when I realized, okay, fine, we're going to have to work on the fairy tale. So we picked up the Three Little Pigs and the wolf, as it so happens. And I said to them, I said, okay, the wolf is the aggressor, he's the bad guy. Life has changed, society has changed. We have to learn to coexist with the wolf now. We can't just say there's one wolf in our life, we kill him off, we move on. Because when one wolf dies, you have another wolf. So let's change the ending and see how you can coexist. Do you know, it was so hard for people to actually give up the story that they've grown up with, because we are our stories. And we live by those stories. So a lot of them rewrote the ending very sweetly for me, but they still made the pigs the victims and the wolf was the aggressor, except for one lady who completely went, she got so upset because she said to me, she said, no, it's not the aggressor. This is not the obstacle. The wolf is our achievement over the obstacle. And it's very subtle, but it's there. So it's not the obstacle, it's our achievement over the, so the idea of coexisting with the wolf was her idea of failure. So the fact is that she had lived her life according to this, that I can defeat my obstacle, I can move forward. And then I'm telling her, no, you've got to coexist. And to her, that became tantamount to failure. So the conversation then went literally into being Jungian versus Kantian philosophy. Mm. And I can always come back to that in a minute if you want to sort of...
No, it's actually very... Great. That's actually a really good point. And you mentioned something on the sanitization or Disneyfication of these tales. Because I mean, I was a big fan, I'm still a big fan of Disney. You know, I love it. And as a child, I used to watch these things. But now, then when you read... I read the original version of Sleeping Beauty. Does anybody know the original version of Sleeping Beauty? I will tell you in half a minute. We all know the princess, she pricks her finger on a spinning wheel and it's cursed and she falls asleep, and then the deal is that a prince has to come and kiss her and then she will wake up. And 100 years go by and everybody has died or fallen asleep, and the palace is in a jungle, and this very young, good-looking, gallant, valiant prince from another kingdom comes. He's heard about this, he's heard this rumour, this myth, this wonderful legend of a beautiful princess sleeping in the palace. And so he's determined to find her, and he comes 100 years later, this happens, and he comes, he kills the dragons, and he cuts through all the jungles, and he finds the palace, enters the palace, finds the beautiful princess. He's been travelling, fighting for 2 or 3 months. He's a young, horny, young man. He sees a beautiful princess sleeping. Before he kisses her, he has his way with her. And then he kisses her, and she wakes up. Now, she wasn't asleep, she was just unconscious, but she was totally aware of what's been happening in the last 100 years. And this is the thing that's happened to her. She's just been raped by this prince. And she wakes up, and she's now stuck with him, because that was the deal. The prince is going to kiss you, and you're going to live happily ever after. She's 100 years older than him, in terms of psychologically, in terms of emotionally, but she is stuck with this prince. That's the original tale of Sleeping Beauty. And there are other similar, darker versions. Compare that to Disney, and it's totally changed. Has Disney done us a favour? Or has modern-day interpretations of these fairy tales done us a favour? Or not, or can both exist?
Okay, so, sorry, is it okay if I... Okay, so, actually, I was just saying, to go back, strangely enough, we can reconnect with the fact that it was a Jungian versus Kantian theory that finally came about. So Jung, of course, being the chap who said that everybody in myth and fairy tale is a reflection of our darker side or what we feel or what we think. So it's about our perspectives and, you know, the characters who go out there. Kant, Immanuel Kant, who is a German philosopher who talked about absolutism. And he says everything has to be absolute. So for instance, he says, if you say that you want to create a stable society, you have to have a homogeneous idea of good. You can't have, okay, this person thinks, well, you know, this is good in my circumstances, this person thinks this is good. You can't have that. It's got to be homogenous. So if you say telling the truth is good, then telling the truth always is always good. Even if it means telling the truth today will get your friend killed, you still have to tell the truth because that is the homogeneous idea of doing good. And that's what our sanitized tales have started to do to us, because it is so good. There is no room for anybody else's choice, anybody else's perspective, and we are now developing into a global world with so many different people, so much diversity, so many other perspectives, so much else that we have to take into consideration, and then we are feeding an entire new generation with stories about no choice and about one perspective. And
right,
we finish
right,
with
wrong is wrong.
Right is right, and there is no wrong. There's no question of wrong, because everything else is wrong. There is this one linear right. There's no kind of strands of thing. And what's very scary is that we all tend to hold on to those stories. And we're actually doing away with the idea of choice as we sanitize the story. So what is going to be the effect of that as we move forward?
Vayuji, you have a huge immense understanding and knowledge of the Indian tales, folk tales, and fairy tales. Do you think over time, without Disney hasn't as yet touched the bulk of our stories. Do you think over time we ourselves, in the last 100 years, 200 years, have sanitized some of our sort of darker versions or some of our more complex tales into this sort of a linear, yes, such a, this is the truth, only this, that sort of thing?
I think there are parallels with the intervention of, obviously, Christianity on some of those fairy tales and the messages that are given. I also feel that we need to look at those fairy tales because if Grimm brothers were collecting them, they were pre-psychology and its terminology. So there is a certain, again, I'm going to refer to A.K. Ramanujan, who talks about how these dark tales or these folk tales operate, because in our Indian pantheon of folk tales, we have some very, very dark moments, you know, and in fact, I'll move to the Chandi or the Durga Saptas, the 700 verses to Durga. Now, initially when you read it, it is a song, it is a story, it is a glorification. And the great celebration is that she is energy, she is a spirit, she is Devi, and she comes into existence because the grand summit of the three gods, Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma, the among anthropomorphized ones, their energy has been neutralized by the demons. And so they focus their three energies together and create this amazing blade of light, and that's Devi. Then you get, by the 7th century, I think, there's this huge celebration and story. Now, what is the story in that? It is about the glorification of this feminine force as a warrior, okay? Now, in the south also, a lot of the Ammans or Shaktis are celebrated as mother, consort of Shiva, feminine force, warrior, but never wife. So she's quite dark, she's got tremendous sexual energy, a very potent warrior-like force. And so I'm just saying that there are different expressions of that similar energy in India, which is contextualized. So when you come to these the Durga story, it's about her having wars with these demons who each one wants to actually possess her body, and there are some very licentious verses about her gorgeousness and stuff like that. But it's very interesting, especially one battle scene which I shall never forget. She rides on these different animals, she's got spears, she's got an army of women, and there's one of these martial demons. She decides that it's no point using any external weapon to strike the body. She gets close enough to him, his head is on the ground, and she sticks two fingers through his nostrils and rips his head off. Now, for somebody just coming at it, this is a prayer, you must be joking. Mm-hmm. But this is what I'm saying, come back to this Indic imagination. The very dark side is also seen as something that acts as a lever and makes you have this very dark, tamasic side, so that you then have a verse which is the Gayatri Mantra, which is when light or realization or consciousness emerges in the mind, it shows you that these are the dark things and this is what is lit, and that's where your choice is as to which side you go. Right? So coming back to your point of sanitization, when I, my grandmother was a sort of a Telugu poet, not published, but she's the one who actually introduced us to the storytelling. And she used to watch us reading Amar Chitrakatha. We had to read it under the rasai, or the duvet, with a torch on. Because when she used to come to inspect lights out, and she caught you with Amar Chitrakatha and these rather diaphanous veils over the bulging breasts of Parvati, she was wondering what were we fantasizing about. And my mother, who was sort of convent English educated, used to explain to my grandmother, look, the think clouds are in English. That's how these children understand the story and they hear these characters. So my grandmother, great champion of Telugu, would say, but I'm here to tell the stories. And it's very interesting because her generation, which is just about pre-sanitization of the Devadasi lyrics in the Bharatanatyam dances, was giving you the real stuff. And her objection was that these think clouds in English are absolute sanitized nonsense. How are these girls really going to grow up in a real world? And that's what these amazing myths did, because it wasn't just some courtesan is so beautiful, or indeed with Ahalya story, it's not just that she was so beautiful and that it's her fault that this person came disguised as her husband when he had gone away to the banks of the river and then he took her. What really happens to Ahalya is the god Indra has been fancying her for so long, he loses control, and at a certain moment, she who has been in this marriage has suddenly realized the expression of her own longings. So interestingly, in the Purana, it shows Indra, when he's cursed by the sage, he has to walk off. It says very delicately, he wore 1,001 eyes all over his body. And those eyes are actually vaginas, so all the gods had to see what he had done. But do you see what I mean? And in a way...
So you won't find that kind of a version in Tulsi Ramayana or in any of the other versions of it. I mean, that's a very specific, probably one or two versions of it will describe it in that level of darkness or detail.
Because, yeah, in the imagination, the darkness is there too. In a way, if you don't have the contrast, what's the point?
Yeah, true. Interesting. I want to just shift it slightly. You mentioned your grandmother had been the one who taught you the fairy tales and all that sort of thing, which is brilliant. In modern day times, who are the writers, and particularly from the West, who are the writers, or which are the stories that you have enjoyed reading or grew up reading that have inspired you to expand your interest in storytelling, not just in India and Indian tales, but actually from all over the world?
I have to say Edgar Allan Poe caught my imagination. I just think it's a very haunting, dark style of language. And yet it's very deep. And there's what I love and what I think is classic is about different expressions of love. And you need to feel, even if you're touched, it should be an echo, like an acoustic mirror, and it must last for a long time. If you're wounded, then you must grow warm with that wound, you know, metaphorically. And I think it's about coming back to these things at different stages in your life and still relishing either the language, the sound, but actually what was that deep thing that happened. So Edgar Allan Poe, and indeed, of course, but I only read Marquez in translation. I'm afraid they're two chaps, but and funnily enough, it was Joan Baez who triggered off the whole notion of ballads and the heroic legends with her Sweet Sir Galahad, which I wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. Simaji, what about you?
So if I have to pick one author...
You can pick two, but one. Start with one.
One author, Neil Gaiman, I think, definitely. He wrote the Sandman series. I don't know if you've come across it, but if you have or you haven't, it's your next reading material. It is very dark stuff. It's so dark. You have to be in a seriously good mood to be able to read it. And what I love about him is that he's a master of global mythologies. So he will pull into his story bits from everywhere, put them together and create one story. And as storytellers in this country, dealing with multicultural audiences, I think that's an incredible skill that we've all had to kind of develop within ourselves. So I think definitely, and I think there's something about the dark, there's something very Jungian in all of us, there's something about the dark that attracts you, that, you know, the moment you have something really sweet and nice and whatever, you know, you kind of think, yeah, whatever, but anything that kind of goes under the surface and makes your hair prickle a little bit and you think, yes. I don't know, maybe it's just as you get older as well, but there's definitely something about
it. I think it is when you get older, but it's also when you get older that change, maybe it was in our late teens or when we grew up further, but that change now is happening much, much earlier.
It is.
In younger children. So I have nieces and nephews who are probably 11, and somehow or other they find True Blood on YouTube, and they are absolutely in love with all this vampires and Game of Thrones. I mean, you know, they shouldn't be watching it, to be honest. But
I shouldn't be watching it.
It's too good. It's too good to watch. It's amazing. But they love anything to do with werewolves, witches, vampires, and all these kind of things. There's a sheer fascination for it, which is not just a trend. It's actually increasing more and more and more. And it's pretty interesting. So there is that dark side of things which people do love.
And yet, we are actually, with our new political correctness and child protection policies, we're going the other way with sanitizing stories. So I'm actually working with the VNA on the sanification. Sanification, yeah. Is that a word? Yeah. We can say that's a word. The sanification of the story from India. So the story actually comes from the Northwest Belt. So it could be Punjab, Pakistan, Afghanistan, could be any of those. And it's really bizarre because the story is about a king who rules over this area, and they have in their culture a system of Balvajir, where you say to the king, I am your Balvajir, you sign your life over to the king. So you do whatever the king does. So if he eats, you eat with him. If he rides, you ride with him. But if he dies, you die with him. You know. So if you say, I am your Balvajir, you live the life of the king. And if he chops his arm off, you chop your arm off. So we are now telling this to, so anyway, there's a party, he has this lovely feast, and he's got this pet parrot, and he's got a pet cat, and he wants this pet parrot to join into the feast, but the parrot does not want to come out, because he's afraid of the cat, and the king says, you bugger, so you know, you've got the king saying, absolutely, do you think I cannot protect you from the cat, come on out, and the parrot says, look, please don't make me come out, I'm afraid of the cat, and finally, the king says, I will be your Balvajir, and so the parrot comes out of his cage, and immediately the cat beats up the parrot. And now, according to his promise, the king has to have his head chopped off. But he doesn't want to, because, I mean, it was just a parrot after all. So he walks around for a whole year with this dead, decapitated parrot wrapped up in white linen and, you know, with lots of clothes around it, trying to find one person who says, it's okay, it was just a parrot, you don't have to die. But he doesn't find anybody. So in the end, he's killed, and all his Balvajirs are killed, and all their Balvajirs are killed, and all their Balvajirs are killed, and several thousand people die because the king said to the parrot, I will be your Balvajir. When we tell this story, I was actually commissioned to tell it for under fives as well as over fives. We are not allowed to say, so we have to stop. We say, you know, we get to that whole point of, you know, now he's going to look out, what is the cat going to do? And the parrot came out, what did the cat do? And the kids all start off by saying, he pounced on the parrot, and then they all kind of go back and they say, but the parrot flew away, and I have to go with that. And if they say it flew back into its cage, then we have the entire kingdom trying to get back into the cage. So we have the entire storytelling session of, you know, then the king was trying to get back and the others were trying to get into the cage. If the parrot flew away to the woods, everybody flies away to the woods. And basically, in the original story, this was a very rich kingdom, and it comes to nothingness. It's reduced to dust, because for a year, the king cannot manage the kingdom. He's going around. So in this, we have the king and all the people doing this, and so it is reduced to dust. But it's amazing how much we get sort of, you know, you just do away with the idea. And it's come down to, so if you wanted to be friends with somebody, what would you do? We could shake hands. That's such a great idea. And that's what it's come down to. So now somebody who's heard this story will go off and write it one of these days as a children's story from India. And it will say, let's all shake hands and be friends, rather than saying, let's be Balvajirs and, you know.
I mean, I've done something similar. So I've written one children's book, a tale based on the Panchatantra, and you can have a look at it downstairs where the books are kept. And it's a much darker tale in the original version, but I was sort of trying to aim it at a 4 to 7 year old audience. So it's been dumbed down in a sense, or sanitized in a sense, really, really to sort of... And you know, Panchatantra tells, like a lot of tales from South Asia are, it's a tale within a tale within a tale within a tale, like a Russian doll type of thing. And then so you have this conversation within a conversation within a conversation, and then you get to the point right at the end. But I've had to sort of invent a point just based on one tale. And that's quite an interesting thing. Something I want to share with you and then see how we can talk about that is, a few years ago, one of the most interesting things I've ever been asked to do is work with the Story Museum in Oxford. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this or been there, but it's the world's first story museum. A lot of Arts Council funding, heritage funding has gone into it. It's a beautiful building, a heritage building like this one, in Oxford, opposite Christ Church College, and they are slowly expanding it. And they want that to be the place where every single story, children's story, from the world is housed in this building. In a book form, in a library form, in an exhibition form, in some way. And audio, internet, all these things. And every year they will have a focus that they do an exhibition on. And 3 years ago they had an exhibition focusing on Alice in Wonderland, which is a very popular classic British tale that has traveled all over the world, translated in something like 200 different languages, which is really phenomenal. I had to do a workshop with a group of refugee and asylum seeker children, mainly from Romania and other parts of Eastern Europe, who are in a school in Oxford, quite a rough area of Oxford. And these kids, 30 of them, came to the Story Museum, and the amazing thing was none of them had ever heard of the story of Alice in Wonderland. They had never heard it, they'd never seen the cartoon, they'd never read the book, nothing at all. So for them it was a totally alien and a totally new tale. The exhibition there had tons and tons of paintings done by European painters who have interpreted Alice's adventures in different ways. And I gave them the task, each child was to pick one painting, look at that painting and think what's going on, and think of a tale or a small story based on that painting. And the amazing thing at the end when they shared these tales were, they were so dark, and they were so real. They were based on terrorism, they were based on families being displaced, they were based on dads going to war, they were based on family members dying, they were based on rape. And to think that Alice's adventures with the Mad Hatter, with the Queen of Hearts, with the, you know, all the different characters in Alice, how they interpreted these paintings in such a dark fashion made me question, how relevant are these stories to the issues that we have today in our current civilization? In your experience, maybe Valerie can start with you, in your experience, or let's talk about it, you mentioned the word emotions that exist in fairy tales. Do you think that, or give an example perhaps, of how these emotions can be relevant or can teach us to deal with today's issues?
I think it's really interesting to see that they don't have a message. Okay, so we're looking at it as non-religious work before they're tainted with, you know, Hinduism or Christianity or Islam. They come from certain cultural spaces. And I want to look at love and death. So let's look at Orpheus. We know the story basically about Orpheus, isn't it? And how he goes to get his love back, and he's told that one thing that you don't turn back to see if she's following you from hell. And he's nearly coming out to life, to the world of the living, but he looks back and she breaks like mist, like glass. In India, there is Savitri. which again is an extraordinary story. But you look at how there are different cultural resonances at the treatments of these. That's why I started out by saying it is, how is this thing being told from a particular cultural imagination or sensibility? So with Savitri too, she loves Satyavan, her husband, you know, beyond everything. She's able to travel for a year through forests, and she finally finds this very handsome man who's a woodcutter with blind parents. And when she's told by Narada, who's the sort of storyteller between the gods and the mortals, don't marry this chap, because if you do, on the 29th day of the 11th month of your marriage, he will die. And you know what it means to be a widow in our culture. And she said, it can't be a curse. It can't be a prophecy. We haven't yet lived it. We don't know enough about the past. How can we know about the future? Mm. And she takes the challenge. So she fasts just before those 4 days when their 1 year of marriage is going to be up. And with very intense fasting and certain yogic practices, she can see into the different realms. And finally, on that day, her husband says, I'm going to chop some wood, I'll be back. And he embroiders this beautiful grassy bank of wild flowers for her to sit on. He gazes into her eyes, holds her face in his warm hands. She can feel the warmth of his living body. And he says, I love you so much, beyond anything. And he goes. And she can hear the wood chopping on the, being chopped, the axe in the wood. And suddenly, the strength of that strike fails. And he just calls out Savitri. By the time she can rush to him, he's dead. Even her finger with the ring on it is not moistened. At that moment, she sees a rather healthy, fat figure riding a buffalo. He's the god of death, with rolling eyes, wax-tipped whiskers, and bull's horns on his head. And he's got these beads which work like percussion. And he says, death is the only truth, and truth is the only death. That's the only certainty in life. Of course, he sees this rather gorgeous-looking woman, and he says, my goodness, I can see you, and I can see that you can see me. So you must be very virtuous. And of course, as we all know, she manages to, through riddles, trick the god of death into bringing her husband back. I'm leaving it at a reasonable cliffhanger so that you will make the effort to go and actually seek Savitri out and read it. Now, again, I'm saying here it is about immense love. That, I mean, in recent times I've seen a, God, that really sounds epic now. There was a wonderful Spanish film called El Orfanato, and it is about a woman who was an orphan, and she finally adopts a child. This child has this terrible disease, which is one in a billion, and she knows this child is going to die, and she loves this whole concept of the child. And so she, when she knows as he's dying, she enters that death. Now, it's incredible, we say death, but the wonderful thing about these myths is they also tell us about the immense power of love. It doesn't matter whether Eurydice doesn't come back. It's the power of love. And when you're grieving, when you're celebrating, when you're entering the prospect of love, or when love has left you, or when you are experiencing loss, these stories are absolute Himalayan landscapes. They hurt you, they heal you, they raise you, they throw you down, they give a kick up to your kundalini and say, okay, now walk without the crutches through life.
That's wonderful. And before I open up for a couple of questions from the audience, I want to say this observation that I've always had with Western fairy tales that have a happy ever after. And a lot of the Indian tales, South Asian tales, also sort of end on a happy note, and if it's not a happy note, then it's not the end. And you see this in a lot of Shakespearean literature as well, where it's all's well that ends well. And then you see it in Bollywood, where we are absolutely, completely fascinated and obsessed with having a happy ending at the end of every Bollywood film. Do you think that this is something which is just inherent in all human beings, that we just must read or see something which ends on a happy note, even if life is miserable in every other way?
The Indian folk tales don't begin, don't end with happily ever after.
Great.
They begin with a marriage, and then all the problems start, which is
I agree. They don't end at all, the Indian stories. I think they just never end, because where it finishes and the next one starts. But I was just thinking of something that Neil Gaiman said. He said, a story never ends, and the only reason to end it is either when you run out of time or the sort of ending that you want, because eventually everything finishes in death. So I think that I object to the happily ever afters hugely, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow and with the same thing, etc. But yeah, no, I think Indian stories, you're right, Barry, they just don't finish. They just kind of go on and on and on,
And African traditions also have that. I think it's something to do with oral traditions, because you have sitting sessions of tellings, isn't it? So how else do you continue? And people who have children, you have to keep reinventing different stories night after night.
So you end it on a cliffhanger, like an EastEnders episode, and so they'll come back again the next day.
And we have to thank Shahrazad for that.
Any questions from the audience? We have a few more minutes. I could go on, but I should give you the opportunity if you have any. Don't be shy. Do please put up your hand and ask. We have two of this country's leading, greatest, I would say, South Asian folk storytellers amongst us, and I think for the very first time in a discussion together. They've shared the stage in a storytelling sense, but never in sort of discussing things.
Great. Thanks for the very good talk so far. You kind of touched on a certain stage where you were saying that today stories for kids at least have become a lot more sanitized, and I was wondering why you thought that was.
We were talking about the Child Protection Act. Why didn't you mention that, please?
Well, as I was saying, there's this whole thing of the child protection policies that are coming in. And so a lot of times when you go into schools or various other places, you actually find people say, we can't use that word, we can't actually say that, we cannot say this. So there's a lot of political correctness. And I have personally been out to tell a story once. And I was telling the story of the Ramayana. I was doing the Diwali story. And I had to do this. We both do this story a lot, and I love that last bit, where you put the bow with the arrow, and then the arrow flies across the battlefield, and how his heads get... I relish that little bit of the story. And these kids walked in, and I don't know why. I normally never tell... Now I start to be really careful, and I kind of give a little heads up, but, later this afternoon, the story is going to be slightly pornographical, people. If you don't feel you're up to it, maybe you should be. So as they walked in, I think I was feeling a little bit bouncy, and I said to this family as they walked in, I said, today's story is really exciting. It's all about, demons having their heads chopped off. And this family said, oh, thank you so much for telling us. Oh, quickly, let's go. Thank you for telling us. We wouldn't want him to hear it. And they actually took their son out. They did not want him to hear the story of a demon getting his head chopped off. And I think it's just about what is now... there are certain things, at least when you go in and work with vulnerable people, that some things are so taboo, it's almost scary. You can't even now kind of hug a person, hug a child without somebody sort of being... So we attended a course where we were told, don't hug the child. When the child comes up to hug you, you stand there and you repeat, say, oh, you want a hug, do you? So everybody can hear you say it, and then it is really, it's all about what is expected of you. So.
Gosh.
No, yeah, it's absolutely a contradiction, isn't it? Because the whole point of the darkness in the stories was to, in a way, get rid of the fear. But the whole business of storytelling, and I'm very grateful to Philip Pullman who keeps putting it back into the agenda and the curriculum, that we need to get back to these classic tales, we need to get back to these folk stories. I wish they would widen the globe of that. The old stories were actually told. So the teller can monitor the level and the threshold of fear of the listener, especially if it's a child. Mm. But if you just leave the child in front of television and there's a bloodbath, or mommy or daddy really don't have time for hurt and mess, then this is why we're going into this cycle of anesthetizing. So that human contact, that chemistry is very important in the telling.
Do I have time to add something?
Yes, absolutely.
It's not just the children's ones. I have to tell you that recently there were some of our friends here who were at this lunch. So I was asked to come and do a talk, and I decided to talk about a book called Kumar Sambhav, which is one of... it was written by Kalidas. It's one of the most erotically beautiful books ever written. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's about when the goddess Parvati goes out and decides that she is going to make love to Shiva to produce this one child that is needed to save the world. And the language in it is absolutely exquisite. And I kind of went in about explaining it. And I talked about how when she finds, you know, the Cupid has been shot. He's killed. And she says, I cannot win him through love anymore. I'm going to have to do a whole series of meditations. And she sits over there. And then it's really hot. And then the rains come. And that first raindrop and how it kind of rolls down her face and over her eyes and over her lips. And it gets here. And then it falls onto her breast and it shatters onto her breast. And then all the little droplets roll down through the little dimples of her. Anyway, we went down this whole path. And it's such a beautiful piece of literature. And at the end of it, I actually had one of the ladies who is marginally older than me, and I'm in my early 50s, said to me, oh, that's okay. In Hindi, she said, it said, you know, oh, in the night now, it doesn't matter. No, but there's no fire, there's no spark. It doesn't matter. We don't need to know. And so she actually decided that this was too erotic, this was too exciting to even be talked about to adults. So she actually decided to sanitize the whole thing anyway. So it doesn't just happen for the children, I'm afraid, that we're actually... I was quite amazed. So in Hindi, she said, Raat ke andhere mein na roshni hai, na chirag hai. And you know, you kind of thought, which literally means there's no spark, no fire. So I don't know. I think that a lot of people just don't want to face the emotions that these stories are likely to bring out for you.
Do you think that stories like that, I mean, the way you described Goddess Parvati in this way, and if there was some right-wing
person... I still have a new forum on my back about a couple of stories.
Okay, so you think... I mean, I want to also just mention that it's in India there's this huge wave of what they call mythological writers. I hate that word, by the way. But mythological writers, Ashok Banker, Amish Tripathi, Devdutt Patnaik, all of these people who are now churning out trilogies and all of these things. In each one, the god or the deity in focus, Shiva, Rama, whoever it is, begins as a human. So he's allowed to be erotic and aroused and all of these things, angry and violent and whatever. But then by the end of the trilogy, has become this devata. And that's how they've got around this sense of not offending anybody. Because yes, the story begins with all of these humanistic characteristics, but by the end of it, look, we have other...
The men, yes, but not the women.
Okay.
What do you
but
think?
Interestingly, in the actual stories, the gods and their courtesans and their really sort of club world, you know, mile high club life, is completely allowed because they have crossed that barrier of mortality, messages, morality, and mediocrity. So they have everything. That's what the churning of the ocean is all about. You want to be fulfilled with golden chariots and this and that. It's in the epic literature about the striving of the human being against all odds to have an ideal and to be ethical. And that has great beauty about it. And I know the word pure is, again, very ugly. I personally find it a very ugly word, because life is about bacteria and, you know, the fertilization of contamination, which makes us so unique and have our signatures. But it's really, the gods are allowed their space. I mean, that's why it is when they cross a boundary that they have to come back and know what it means to be human. That's the whole story of Bhishma, that's the whole story of Ganga, and that's why the Vasus come back. They had everything, beautiful wives, jewelry, you know, never knew hunger, never knew disease. So that's why when you have a Buddha, you have everything in this mortal life. Good fortune must never be mocked.
Good fortune was never been mocked. What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for having a really interesting discussion. I'm slightly aware that for many of you, some of the references made, churning of the ocean and this and that, will be like, what is that? I don't know that story. So take the opportunity now. I think we're going to be going next door. There'll be some drinks and things that Jumam will tell you. But both of our wonderful storytellers are here, so just sort of have a notebook and pen and say, what was that thing you said? And write it down, go and Google it, find out about it, because there are so many beautiful stories out there that really deserve to be read, understood, and then retold.
Or indeed, Asia House should invite us all to tell those stories again.
Again, next time. Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.